Most of the people who settled the early American colonies are shrouded in mystery, more than three centuries later. Records are scarce, and while we do know a good deal about the famous people of the era, we possess little that illuminates the lives of the ordinary folk. What little we do know comes from the stories, letters, and diaries that survive. We know they came to America in sailing ships, crammed with people, animals, and whatever belongings they could bring with them. Sickness, including the near constant nausea from being tossed by the waves, plagued them. Many died on the way, never reaching the New World at all. They brought a piece of the Old World with them, with their histories and their traditions. They brought their hopes, dreams, fears, horrors, and faith in the new God. Some escaped persecution for their religious beliefs, and some of them were the persecutors. They left Europe at a time when thousands were being accused, tortured, hanged, and burned for being witches. And they came to America for a fresh start. The new arrivals on these shores knew about witchcraft. They feared it and maybe experienced it or even practiced it firsthand. They brought their beliefs in the supernatural with them to their new home across the sea. Some came to escape the devil, only to find him waiting in the woods, forests, and fields of America. As one old New Englander said, reflecting late in his life about his decision to come to America 50 years before, he'd come to the New World to free himself from the evil forces of his former home, but to his dismay, he stated, "I found here a devil to tempt and a corrupt heart to deceive." And he wouldn't be alone in this belief. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to our new season, Woods and Fields, Dark and Wicked, which is hosted and produced by Cody Beck and written and performed by Troy Taylor. That's me. We have a long road ahead of us this season, traveling to America's forests, farms, and fields with tales of witchcraft and hexes, cults and curses, calamities and cannibalism, massacres and mysterious disappearances, and have more magic, mayhem, sinners, and spirits than we've ever offered before. So sit back, light a candle, and let us introduce you to the American Witch. Witches seem to be plentiful in America. Stories, rumors, legends, and gossip about witches spread from farm to farm and village to village throughout the colonies. Witches could be found among the settlers, but worse, there was real terror about black magic being produced by the Native Americans among them. These fears stretch back to the Old World. A large and constantly expanding amount of writing about traveling in America had cast the Native Americans as devil worshippers, even though the First Nations people had no idea who the Christian devil was. Community leaders and preachers called them minions of Satan, conjurers, and consorters with evil angels. Most of those accusations came about because of the Native American practices of traditional medicine, which, as we'll find out, would be suspicious no matter who was doing it, as the Africans arriving on American shores would also discover. Small groups of Africans had been arriving in the British colonies as early as 1619. Of course, they were immigrants of a very different sort, since they'd been kidnapped from their homelands and transported to America against their will. Even though they were held in bondage as slaves, they would always fall under suspicion for their persistence in following the traditions they brought with them to America. In their homelands, magical practice, including witchcraft and sorcery, had been central to the supernatural belief systems of the people. To the colonists, this was something to be feared. Many writings of the period refer to conjurers and poison doctors among the slave population. There were references to magical practices, to charms, invocations, and substances such as powders, roots, and herbs. And while most of their magical practices were confined to the black population, white slave owners and townspeople feared harm from the sorcery practiced by their slaves, and with good reason, let's be honest. However, on far too many occasions when a white person died under mysterious circumstances, slaves were often blamed. Dozens, if not hundreds, of slaves were suspected, accused, convicted, and put to death for alleged acts of poisoning or murder by magic. But it wasn't really the indigenous people or the slaves the colonists truly feared. Diabolical danger, they believed, would be coming from their own kind. It was the dark arts produced by the settlers themselves. You see, the most dangerous witches were those found within their own ranks. Despite how it seems, though, witch mania wasn't running rampant through all the colonies. In the central colonies, along the mid-Atlantic, for example, concern about witchcraft rarely led to any official action. In others, especially Puritan New England, it was a deeply rooted, malevolent presence. There, formal accusation involving whole communities and generating full-blown legal proceedings remained plausible, even likely. The most relentless persecution of witches in England took place when the country was dominated by the Puritans, so it's no surprise that most American witches were hunted down in New England. While a deep faith in the new god provided much of the courage and endurance shown by the founding members of the individual colonies, their faith often veered into fanaticism. Their religious beliefs forced a strict adherence to the word of their god, and they would not tolerate anyone who questioned even a single passage in the Bible, including the Old Testament verse about not suffering a witch to live. Few other regions were so fanatical, and yet witchcraft was still reported elsewhere in the colonies. Virginia was the site of the first British settlement in America, and Virginia was also the source of the earliest surviving report of witchcraft. In 1626, the colony's general court heard charges against a woman named Joan Wright, a so-called very odd woman who told fortunes, usually about someone's impending death, and uttered mysterious threats to anyone who crossed her. This included a man who failed in hunting despite, quote, coming to good game and very fair to shoot at, and another man whose plants were all drowned. She was also accused of having made an entire family dangerously sore, whatever that means. But most stories of witchcraft in this region came not from chasing witches, but from court cases in which people sued other people who accused them of being a witch. There were about 20 of these, with roughly even splits between acquittals and convictions. Punishments, when ordered, typically involved paying a fine or making a public apology. Well, there are records that exist about the kinds of accusations made against alleged witches. They usually involve curses and spells. Like one woman who was said to have uttered a, quote, kind of prayer against her neighbor that, quote, neither her nor any of his family might prosper. Shortly after, sickness overtook the neighbor's family. Another man claimed bewitchment of his cow, and another, injury to his horse, and yet another, the sudden and mysterious death of some chickens. Several described experiences of being ridden like a beast of burden by supposed witches over long distances, usually at night. One incident like this left the victim, quote, wearied nearly to death. There were also occasional references to the devil's imps and also to shape-shifting, you know, people changing into a black cat or some other animal. There were also elaborate stories of counter-magical activity. In one instance, a woman who thought herself to be bewitched ordered a servant to take a horseshoe and fling it into the oven, and when it was red hot, to fling it into her urine. According to the servant, the remarkable tactic produced immediate and telling results. Quote, so long as the horseshoe was hot, the witch was sick at heart, and when the iron was cold, she was well again. When a possible witch was actually prosecuted, this involved having a jury sworn in, witnesses called, and defendants interrogated. The suspect's body was carefully examined for, quote, teats, spots, and marks not usual on others. If found, these imperfections were attributed to the devil and understood to be flesh that was used as nipples to suckle his imps. In addition, the homes of defendants were searched for all kinds of images and such like things as may strengthen the suspicion. End quote there. And at least a few suspected witches were ordered to be tried in the water by ducking. This time-tested method of discovery meant that the accused would be immersed in a pool or stream. If she floated too easily, the devil was presumed to be at work on her behalf. If she sank, or better yet, if she drowned, then she was obviously innocent of her charges, all the charges that had been brought against her. It's kind of a lose-lose situation, no matter how it turned out. Well, Virginia was the first colonial site for court proceedings over witchcraft, and it also turned out to be among the last. Some trials occurred as late as 1706. Meanwhile, there were similar cases in nearby Maryland. Most of these, though, revolved around slander. A typical case involved a man named Peter Godson, who was confronted by his neighbor, Richard Manship, who'd heard Godson say that Manship's wife was a witch. Godson said he'd gone to Manship's home, and the other man's wife, allegedly as a joke, placed two straws on the floor and told Godson that if she was a witch, then he would not be able to step over them. Well, Godson did step over them, but was struck lame the following day, which he claimed proved that Mrs. Manship was a witch. Well, Richard Manship sued him for libel. Godson later retracted his accusation and the court case against him was dismissed, but I'm going to say that Godson and Manship's friendship was never really quite the same after that. Well, New York witnessed occasional witchcraft trials, including a lengthy one in 1665 that charged a Long Island couple named Ralph and Mary Hall with using certain, quote, detestable and wicked arts, commonly called witchcraft and sorcery, to cause the illness of a neighbor named George Wood and his infant child. In the end, there were no convictions. A jury found that there were some suspicions of guilt in the woman, but not enough to take away her life. Generous. Her husband was acquitted outright. Pennsylvania was founded in 1682, later than many of the other colonies, so it had a briefer involvement with the witchcraft trials of the era. The Quakers, who made up the majority of the population in those days, had little to do with such things, but a handful of cases did surface. In 1684, William Penn, the oatmeal guy, and his counsel conducted a full-blown prosecution of charges against two women, Margaret Matson and Greta Hendrickson. They were accused of bewitching cows and practicing other sorceries over a span of 20 years. The jury returned an unusual form of split verdict. Quote, guilty on the common fame of a witch, but not guilty in the matter and form as she stands indicted. Yeah, I'm not really sure what that means either. By the late 1600s, concern with witchcraft, at least official concern with witchcraft, was beginning to fade. Indeed, in all places outside of New England, it never really amounted to a great deal anyway. It was rarely a part of local culture, and while it could for a little while attract a lot of attention, it really never amounted to much. For the most part, what happened in America was nothing like the witchcraft frenzy that had occurred in the old world. Well, until we look at what happened to witches among the Puritans in New England. The Puritans hold a special place in American history. This group of settlers, actually two groups, the Mayflower Pilgrims who arrived at Plymouth in 1620 and the much larger contingent that arrived in Boston about a decade later, are considered America's first religious fanatics. The Puritans fled England because of persecution. They wanted a place where they could worship as they saw fit, out from under the thumb of the Church of England. They'd grown disgusted with what they saw as the church's corruption and strain from the purity that they demanded from their faith. The Puritans who settled in New England had no intention of letting go of their unyielding Bible-based convictions. They never considered democracy, not as we know it. There was no separation between church and state. Their religious beliefs influenced all community and political decisions. As God-fearing Christians, the Puritans saw the devil as their enemy, whom they needed to be always vigilant against, for Satan always lurked nearby, ready to claim the souls of anyone at any time. For the Puritans, fear and superstition were simply part of their faith. The Puritans dominated every aspect of a community's existence. Life was not easy. Hard work and prayer consumed most of a person's time. There was a genuine fear of insufficient crops and food supplies. There were illnesses and epidemics, Indian attacks, and squabbles and disputes between neighbors. For the religious, they believed the wrath of their God was responsible for nearly anything that went wrong, from inclement weather to disease. If the Puritans wanted to improve their fortunes, they believed they should spend more time being prayerful in the worship of God. Underlying many of the Puritans' problems was a feeling of helplessness and terror of the unknown. The uneasiness and anxiety of a village created the perfect climate for seeking scapegoats. Any affliction could be attributed to the eccentric, the difficult, the elderly, and those not pious enough. It was convenient to accuse them of being witches or sorcerers in league with the devil and his demons. And while the adults faced both genuine and imagined stresses, children were permitted few, if any, of the joys or freedoms associated with childhood. They were to be seen and not heard, to be obedient, industrious, and prayerful. Boys were taught skills they would need as adults, farming, building, and hunting. They learned to read and write so they could comprehend the Bible. Girls didn't need to be literate. They needed to learn cooking, sewing, and household skills. There was little else to break the grim monotony of their days and nights. The Puritans spent most of their time fighting the evil influences of the indigenous people, other religious faiths, and the devil, of course. But what they believed was their most sinister challenge came not from a competing sect or religion, but from the tradition of folk magic. Interest and belief in magic had crossed the ocean with the first wave of colonists and had firmly taken root in the cultural soil of America. It was frequently referred to in letters, writings, and sermons by Puritan ministers, condemning it as the practice of curing sickness and bringing good luck through conjuring. Courts studied into it, most often as part of witchcraft prosecutions. Ordinary people mentioned its use and often its success in their diaries and in letters to one another. Even some of New England's leaders and authorities were among its faithful. Folk magic practitioners were known as cunning men and women and assisted those who came to them in times of need. Most of the time, it was for a cure to an illness or for divining, which was the use of occult methods to foretell the future or to find lost or stolen objects. Folk magic was truly a matter of folk, ordinary individuals who knew something of traditional lore and sought to apply it in the best way they could. They healed the sick using medicines and plants, providing help for people in ways that established medicine at the time just simply couldn't. There was a fine line between beneficial magic, like healing and divining, and diabolical magic, and in many cases, the difference was in the eye of the beholder. Some magic, meant to be helpful, could easily be turned another way. Image magic was considered especially potent and dangerous. For example, the use of poppets, which was a sort of witch doll, to represent particular human targets. Treat the dolls with kindness, and the intended recipient of the magic thrives. But pinch, prick, or twist the poppet, and the intended victim might fall ill, break into fits, or perhaps even suffer a mortal injury. Records exist of the authorities searching the suspect's house for evidence of these dolls, and occasionally they found what they were seeking. One case file from Boston noted the discovery of, quote, several small images made of rags and stuffed with goat hair and other ingredients. Folk magic also offered charms or counter magic that could be directed at a witch. For example, urine might be taken from a witch's victim, poured into a special container, infused with pins and nails, and heated over a fire, which I'm sure smelled great. But this was supposed to cause an immediate reaction, scalding, burning, or some other painful sensation in the suspected witch, wherever she might be. This same trick might also force her to return to the scene of the crime. In one such case, a suspect was seen walking to and fro near her victim's house for several hours after a certain urine-filled bottle was opened. In this way, both revenge and identification were achieved in one stroke. The key element in every instance was a powerful line of influence that was believed to connect the witch to her victim, a sort of invisible tether, with effects that could travel in either direction. Fortune-telling was also a big part of folk magic, using palms, eyes, crystal balls, the stars, keys, nails, scissors, tea leaves, and more. The list was long, and it seemed just about anything could be associated with the powers of the occult. There were charms, too, involving the use of mysterious words and letter combinations, sometimes written and sometimes spoken. There were secret healing phrases as well as spoken curses with ill words that were designed to injure. Good or bad, though, the clergy of New England kept up an intense and hate-filled opposition toward magic. For them, it was a sacrilege, an affront to their own authority, and most of all, to their gods. If the common people needed protection from the bad things in life, it must come from God and no one else, they thought. Suffering should be relieved through solemn prayer and not by the workings of folk magic. The true religion, as they called it, was divinely ordained. Conjuring and magic was not. Wherever magic had apparently succeeded in achieving some intended effect, its source could only be deception by the devil himself. Reverend Cotton Mather wrote about folk magic. He wrote, "'Tis in the devil's name that such things are done, and in God's name I do this day charge them as vile impedities." Just to make sure he got his point across, he added, "'They are a sort of witches who thus employ themselves.'" Puritan ministers knew that the best way to denigrate folk magic was to unfairly link it to witchcraft and the devil. As this controversy simmered, ordinary folks were often caught in the middle. Resisting the clergy's pressure to choose, these people would remain Christians, remain churchgoers, remain adherents to the Puritan doctrine, yet they'd also avail themselves of magical remedies when they had to, risking the danger of being labeled as a witch. To the Puritans, a belief in witches who carried out the devil's evil deeds was as real and as constant as the devil himself. Witchcraft was against the law in most New England colonies and was punishable by death. And for good reason, it seems. The Puritans believed that witches could put spells on livestock that made the animals become ill or die. Witches even had the power to deform or kill newborn babies. It was the devil, they believed, not the high infant mortality rates of the era. An inappropriate look, a pointed finger, or harsh words might be construed as an evil curse. And it was during this time of confusion about folk magic, witchcraft, and a belief that the devil was walking among them that New England's notorious role in the saga of the American witch began. There are records of witchcraft being practiced in Massachusetts as early as 1637, although honestly, this case seemed to have more to do with the fact that the accused was a woman rather than that she was a witch. Anne Hutchinson, at the center of the controversy, seemed to challenge the very foundations of the Puritan establishment. The daughter of an Anglican minister, she was a unique presence for her time. Deeply thoughtful, eloquent, visionary, and charismatic. The mother of 15 children, she was an amazingly energetic woman, I'd say so, who worked as a midwife and held Bible study groups in addition to running a large household. Anne gathered a large following composed of Boston folk who attended her special worship meetings, and this served as something that attracted attention. Governor John Winthrop, her primary enemy, referred to her as a prophetess, and the term does seem fitting. Anne was greatly admired, but many others were suspicious of her. Her prophecies were laced with such wit that no one knew if they should take them seriously or not. But to the Puritans, a woman with a sense of humor, well, that was pretty much as bad as being a witch. 2 years after arriving in Massachusetts, Anne's gift, said to be beyond nature, got her into trouble. She was brought before the religious authorities because, as Governor Winthrop wrote, quote, her doings gave cause of suspicion of witchcraft. As it turned out, she was never formally accused of being a witch. Her trial, conviction, and subsequent banishment focused instead on opinions that she had went against the Puritan faith and was defying authority. She was then, maybe as an afterthought, charged with being, quote, deluded by the devil. In addition, two of her friends, Jane Hawkins and Mary Dyer, were also accused. Jane, like Anne, was a midwife whose practice allegedly included the use of traditional fertility potions. As a result, according to Winthrop, she became, quote, notorious for familiarity with the devil. Mary and Anne had both experienced problems with childbirth. In Mary's case, the baby was stillborn and was badly deformed. Mary, too, gave birth to a severely deformed baby, which died within minutes. Such monstrous births, as they were regarded at the time, were a clear sign of some diabolical influence. The only reason that suspicions against the women did not lead immediately to witchcraft was that the usual prelude to a witchcraft trial which was the gradual, piece-by-piece buildup of suspicion and doubt over many years, accompanied always by neighborhood gossip, was lacking in their case. All three women were relatively recent arrivals to Boston, and so were their adversaries. In a sense, neither side knew the other well enough to support a full measure of witchcraft allegations. In fact, there were no witchcraft trials in New England at all during the quarter century following the landing of the Mayflower in Plymouth Harbor in 1620. People needed to get to know each other better before they could start accusing each other of frolicking with the devil. Once they started, though, the trials went on until almost the end of the century. The communities that surrounded Massachusetts Bay, unfortunately, became well known for their witchcraft trials. A little-known case in 1648 resulted in the execution of a woman referred to only as Goodwife Kendall. Another proceeding in 1648 against Margaret Jones of Charlestown brought the same outcome. Margaret had been acting as a healer and fortune teller, and details of her methods aroused suspicions about her. Her medicines healed the sick, and yet she, quote, showed such a malignant touch as many persons she stroked or touched with any affection or displeasure were taken with deafness or vomiting or other pains or sickness. When she was searched for the devil's mark, she was found to have a, quote, apparent teat in her secret parts. A witness to her nights in prison as she awaited her trial noted the comings and goings of a familiar spirit in the shape of a little child. Well, over the course of the next few years, a number of slander cases emerged in Massachusetts communities that were filed on behalf of women against neighbors who had defamed them by intimating or openly charging that they were involved in witchcraft. Several of them have been accused of conducting meetings with the devil at their homes. In 1652, a more substantial and serious case took place in Springfield, Massachusetts. At the center of the events was a married couple, Hugh and Mary Parsons. Mary was accused of murdering her infant son. Numerous accounts and depositions were filed against them both, and the list of supernatural events of which they were accused included mysterious disappearances, strange illnesses, and injuries, threatening speeches, especially by Hugh Parsons, and perhaps most important, fits in several of their apparent victims. Mary seems to have admitted her guilt, and her own testimony recounted startling details of, quote, a night when I was with my husband and good wife Merrick and Bessie Sewell in Goodman Stebbins' lot. We were sometimes like cats and sometimes in our own shape, and we were applauding for some good cheer. It doesn't sound like witchcraft, but it certainly sounds like something, let's say, interesting. Her conviction and execution shortly followed her confession. Hugh Parsons, although he denied all of it, was convicted and condemned to death. However, the verdict was later reversed and he fled to Rhode Island. Whatever happened to the other suspects was never recorded. What is clear, though, is that Springfield was in a great upheaval during the many months of the unfolding events, since participants in the Parsons trial came from over half of the households in town. Another striking case occurred in Boston in 1656. The defendant, Anne Hibbins, was a person of unusually high social status, as her husband, William, was not only a wealthy merchant, but an admired civic leader, a magistrate, and a member of the Court of Assistants, the colony's highest governing body. Anne doubtless shared in the prestige of her husband's position, and yet her abrasive personality frequently caused her grief. In 1640, she had engaged in a long and bitter dispute with a group of carpenters who had been hired to refurbish her house. She accused them of cheating her. A resultant lawsuit in civil court was resolved in her favor, but the manner in which she pursued the case was so aggressive that the Boston church called her to account in a widely publicized inquest. When she refused to apologize for her actions, the church first admonished and then excommunicated her. She must have been something else. Her husband pleaded on her behalf, yet he also admitted that she could be both uncharitable and very unchristian-like. Church authorities accused her of wronging him also, complaints that Anne just really ignored. As the years passed, Anne had other problems with the townspeople of Boston, but little could be done about her because of her husband's standing in the community and the fact that he was so well-liked. But when William died in 1654, Anne lost her protection, and within a few months, she was conveniently accused and arraigned as a witch. The details of her final trial have been lost, but its outcome is known. She was convicted of witchcraft and hanged. Around the same period, suspicion surrounded many other people against whom rumors of being witches would circulate for decades. Eunice Cole of Hampton, New Hampshire was one of them. There was also Elizabeth Godman of New Haven, Connecticut, Jane James of Marblehead, Massachusetts, John Godfrey of Andover, Massachusetts. These individuals all fit a classic pattern in which a reputation for practicing witchcraft might never be escaped from. And thanks to this, they were subject to repeated court prosecutions. John Godfrey's story was particularly remarkable. In one respect, it was unusual because he was a man. Within the relatively small number of accused men, most were husbands of suspected women. Their guilt was always one of association, but Godfrey was different in that he was unmarried and in fact had no family relations at all. He'd arrived in Massachusetts sometime around 1642 and had almost immediately become mixed up in a number of legal proceedings, suing numerous people and being sued in return, clogging up the courts with lawsuits for debt, breaches of promise, slander, contempt for authority, and more. He won more cases against his neighbors than he lost, but he was also a frequent defendant, being accused of theft, arson, perjury, and physical assault. And not surprisingly, since he was a thorn in the side of nearly everyone around him, he was accused again and again of practicing witchcraft. He was an unlikable man, continually at odds with his peers and over a score of personal and usually mundane affairs. He was portrayed as angry, rough, and threatening. Now, these were all characteristics that New Englanders expected of their witches, and the accusations against him followed a typical pattern. In other words, if you made enough people angry with you in that time and place, you could expect at some point to be accused of being a witch. It seemed like the best way to put some people in their place. Well, it's notable that Godfrey remained at large to fight with his Essex County neighbors for more than three decades, until his death in 1675. Five times he stood in court under formal indictment for witchcraft, which was a capital crime, and five times he narrowly escaped conviction. At least once, a jury declared him, quote, suspiciously guilty of witchcraft, but not legally guilty, according to the law and evidence we've received. Put on notice again and again, he just kept coming back for more. No one can ever truly explain the motives behind Godfrey's constant antagonism, but he simply refused to go away. And Eunice Cole was the female version of John Godfrey. She too was repeatedly accused and often prosecuted for witchcraft, but never convicted. She was also uncommonly rough and abrasive, given to unseemly speeches and physical brawls. Her reputation was widely known, and it would long outlive her. Tales of her supposed witchcraft entered into local folklore and was told to generation after generation. Even today, centuries later, children in Hampton know her name and tell of her supposed misdeeds and even shudder a little when they pass near her old home site. The stories of Elizabeth Godman and Jane James were variations on the same theme. There were years of suspicion, occasional court trials, and acquittals each time, often accompanied by stern warning. In these cases, too, though, the women lived next door to the same people who accused them of being witches for years. They became fixtures of local culture, almost as familiar as Sabbath services, autumn harvests, and barn raisings. In the 1660s, New England experienced its first witchcraft panic, and that's the best way to describe it. Accusations against alleged witches spread and multiplied like a contagion, and each new accusation was fed by the one before it. It began in Hartford, Connecticut, and while its exact origin remains unknown, it seems to have begun with the very strange fits of a young woman in town. As they developed, quote, her tongue was improved by a demon to express things which she herself knew nothing of. Well, she apparently also began speaking in what they called a Dutch tone or German, and then revealed, quote, mischievous designs by such and such persons against several neighbors. One of the accused persons was a, quote, certain lewd and ignorant woman named Rebecca Greensmith, who was already in jail, suspected of witchcraft. Going by the established procedures, the accused was examined by a group of magistrates and ministers who managed to get her to put together a pretty impressive confession. She described all sorts of familiarity with the devil, including, quote, carnal knowledge of her body, and described witch meetings that occurred near her house. Some of the witches appeared in one shape, others in another, and one came flying amongst them in the shape of a crow. That's a quote. No one knows why she confessed to the things she did, although one witness to her interrogation stated that Rebecca felt, quote, as if her flesh had been pulled from her bones and she could not deny her guilt any longer. Well, this seems to suggest some sort of torture took place. Well, regardless, her statements were more than enough to bring about her conviction and a sentence of death. Her husband was also executed, even though he claimed to be innocent until the end. Since the fits experienced by the unnamed young woman pointed to a self-proclaimed witch who confessed to having had sex with the devil and met with other witches from around the area, there was every reason for the authorities to continue their investigation. Accusations spread out across Hartford and into neighboring towns like Wethersfield and Farmington. The details of everything that happened have been lost to history, but a few things are still known. Suspicion fell on a particular married couple, and a group of townspeople decided to try the notorious ducking test. Husband and wife were both tied at their hands and feet and then thrown into the water. When they appeared to float, bystanders concluded that the devil must be holding them up. Well, the ministers who reported on the use of this procedure regarded it as an ignorant superstition and may have even tried to intervene. Now, no one knows one way or the other, but we do know the couple managed to escape. Others, of course, were not so lucky. Among the additional suspects, 4 were acquitted, 6 were convicted, and at least 2 were executed. It made for a death toll unrealized during any other single period until events that would later occur in 1692. In the 1670s, there were incidents in Massachusetts and Connecticut and even in rarely affected Rhode Island. But the middle part of the decade brought new challenges to the American colonies and turned attention away from witchcraft for a time. The greatest distraction was King Philip's War, a horrific race war that pitted the white colonists and their Mohegan and Pequot Indian allies against Indians from 5 other nations. The human toll was unparalleled before or since in American history because the casualty rate approached 10% of the total colonist population, and it was even higher among the natives. As a result, in the 4 years between 1675 and 1679, only one accusation of witchcraft drew an indictment. But at the war's end, the pace increased with 6 witch trials over the next 4 years. There were additional indictments in the half dozen years after that, none of which resulted in convictions. It's worth noting that no one was executed for witchcraft anywhere in New England between 1663 and 1688. It began to seem as though the witchcraft craze was running its course. But then in 1688, a strong prosecution developed in Boston against an alleged witch named Glover. Her first name was not recorded. She was Irish, Gaelic-speaking, and likely a Catholic, all of which would have cast her in a dubious light for most New Englanders. Her leading accusers and supposed victims were the residents of a neighboring farm who hired her to do their laundry. Well, the course of events was a familiar one. There was a dispute, angry words, fear of retaliation, then of course, fits among the neighbor's children. The result was a full-blown trial, ending in Glover's conviction, confession, and execution. Other suspects were linked to Glover, and the people of Boston became more and more alarmed. The local clergy was involved, especially Cotton Mather. Eventually, the children's fits stopped, and a kind of normalcy returned to the community. Glover's was the first New England witchcraft case to end in capital punishment in 25 years, but of course it wouldn't be the last. As the final decade of the 17th century began, New Englanders were feeling upset and frightened by events taking place at home and at distant corners of the colonies. On the political and military front, the major European powers, together with their various colonial possessions, were at war. In America, this meant New England was at odds with New France, or Canada, it was known then, and violent though sporadic fighting was occurring throughout the wilderness borderlands. Many of the targets included villages in Maine, New Hampshire, and New York, several of which suffered from devastating surprise attacks. But perhaps more frightening was the renewal of the witchcraft panic that had seized the region in years past. Accusations surfaced in Boston, New Haven, and Northampton. In 1692, a significant outbreak gripped the coastal Connecticut towns of Stamford and Fairfield. Those events began in March in the home of a locally prominent family when a servant girl named Catherine Branch suddenly, quote, fell into fits. The details followed a long-established precedent. Wild physical contortions, trances, fainting spells, cursing and blasphemies, suggestive sexual acts, spectral confrontations with the devil, and finally, the naming of her supposed witch tormentors. Once again, it all happened in the presence of numerous enthralled onlookers, all of whom were willing to carry the tales to family and friends. After names were given, no fewer than six women were brought under suspicion. A special court was convened and dozens of witnesses offered testimony about their dealings with the accused. They all spoke of quarrels, threats made and received, cows that died mysteriously, and strange injuries of every sort. The proceedings continued throughout the summer, and the atmosphere surrounding them was both angry and circus-like. Local townspeople divided into opposing factions, with some supporting and others doubting or dismissing outright the various charges. The doubters included several members of the court and a group of ministers whose opinion was given about the ridiculousness of the entire charade. In the end, their viewpoint prevailed, with only two of the suspects being indicted. They were tried before a jury who found one of the women guilty. She was eventually freed by a committee of magistrates. But at almost the same moment that Catherine Branch was seized by fits in Connecticut, something similar was taking shape about 100 miles to the north, where a group of impressionable young girls had a notion to try their fortunes. Hoping to learn the identity of their future husbands by using an old divining trick of dropping an egg white into a glass to see what patterns it formed. Instead of news about their matrimonial prospects, though, the girls allegedly saw a sure sign of death, leading to shock, terror, strange antics, and whispered accusations. The horror was taking place in Salem, Massachusetts, and it was about to be revealed to the rest of the American colonies.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? And I don't mean like spells or incantations to trap spirits, you weirdos. I mean like a new language that could help you start communicating with more people on this plane today. Then I need to tell you about Rosetta Stone. Look, you know the brand, you know the name. They have the expertise and a 30-year legacy, which makes them more qualified than ever to help you learn a new language today. They've helped millions of people build the fluency and confidence to speak new languages. Now, this is the part where Troy would tell me that I made some kind of grammatical error, but he's not here right now, so like, I don't know, it's like speaking tongues. Rosetta Stone focuses on speaking practice for real-life scenarios to get you ready for real conversations with real people. Or maybe you can even learn how to use some different types of Ouija boards. I don't know. Either way, Rosetta Stone can help you learn faster and retain your new language better. Honestly, Rosetta Stone really would have come in handy for season 4 of New Orleans, because I know we butchered some of those French names, and I apologize once again. Now, you all know I have a 9-to-5 job when I'm not at the podcast factory, and Rosetta Stone actually helped me not make a total fool out of myself while I was in Brazil interviewing celebrities. Obrigado. And now I want to help you. So don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, American Hauntings podcast listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Rosetta Stone, how language is learned. Wait, by the way, Troy, like, where do words come from? Hey, no, don't walk away. Oh, Troy, where do words...
I mean, there are a couple of spots, because, you know, when sure. I find a spot,
you really
I cannot get past it.
You keep hitting it and hitting it. And hitting
it. There's a couple of them. There's one that I know I went, fuck, like that in the microphone. I went, oh, God, Cody's going to hear that. Son of a bitch.
Oh, that's funny. I mean, I can usually tell, like I said, by, like, looking at the audio waves, but usually I listen anyway to hear, like, what... funny mm-hmm. thing you said, or you like, because I know you leave me little notes and stuff.
I always like, get, I will often get creative when I get frustrated. I'm a motherfucking bitch, man.
One time, yeah.
right.
Okay. Thanks for tuning into the American Hauntings Podcast, the show where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. We are now in season 6 of the podcast, Woods and Fields, Dark and Wicked. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
I guess you didn't see that thing in your contract, did you, about how you're supposed to say the title of the season?
No.
You can't just say it like that. You have to say it like
spooky
woods and fields, dark and wicked.
That's good. You have such a better radio voice than I do.
I feel like
we should splice. I'm just going to splice.
You just
that
made
in
it sound
time.
So. You just made it sound
woods
too,
and fields,
too
dark
peppy.
And wicked.
Yeah.
Woohoo. I gotta wake the people up. Because I know everybody.
Well, yeah. After that, after the marathon monologue that I just gave you.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we may have lost some people.
Well, I'm also thinking people.
Sleep.
I'm guessing I put these episodes out usually around 3 a.m. I know everybody's setting their alarms.
Oh,
they're getting
right.
up. They're listening, and I'm trying to keep them. You know, I'm getting their coffee because I know they want to get down to it. What's up, dude? We're in this. What do you call?
Well,
this
we're back
now?
In the. We've been calling it the American Hauntings Ballroom.
Okay.
I mean, it's the Crystal Ballroom, officially. That's,
lack of crystal balls in here, too.
Yeah, there are no crystal balls. I'm not sure why it was called that originally, although it was the restaurant at the Mineral Springs Hotel.
Was there a chandelier or something, maybe?
Well, no, there are some pretty lights. It's that stuff they put in the plaster on the ceiling. I just figured it out. How sad is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, 108 years later.
And we've talked about the plaster a lot, too.
Why that's up there. Now we know. Well, anyway, it is now the American Hauntings Crystal Ballroom. We can call it all of it if you want, but this is where we have all of our events, our dinner events. Our River Road tours end up here at the end of the night before we go down and visit other portions of the hotel. And this is where we have a bookstore here in Alton, and this is where we have started recording our podcasts.
It's so cool.
I like it.
It's a nice little hang.
It's a comfortable place. It's very, for me, it's very homey because I feel like I live here all the time.
I mean, it looks just like parts of your apartment or your office and stuff. So, yeah. Well, it's been a little while. What's been going on?
Yeah, a couple weeks. So not too bad. So, well, the Haunted America conference tickets went on sale. They were going on sale right after we recorded the last time and the day before this came out. But I should tell anybody, if you are interested in the conference, it's more than half sold out already.
Damn.
So we've already reached over the halfway point. Now, last year, that was not a big deal because we had a lot of carryover people from 2020.
Right.
You know, that rescheduled for 2021. So, you know, having it half full a week and a half after the tickets went on sale was not a big deal. This year, kind of a big deal. In other words, if you're planning on coming, you really need to make your plans.
You got
to
figure it out.
Because it is filling up quickly. So, and that's exciting. We had a lot of cool stuff planned for that. You could find it all on the website, of course. But the big thing that we should talk about right now is Dead of Winter, which is coming up now in just a couple of weeks. It's going to be here before we know it.
I know. I got to get a babysitter
for my cat.
Let's see.
This is 2 weeks from today?
Is
no,
it?
3 weeks. 3 weeks from today.
Okay.
But still, 3 weeks.
Yeah.
That's pretty quick. If you don't know about Dead of Winter, you can go back to listen to every other season of the podcast where we have done live shows from Dead of Winter. But Dead of Winter is an annual food drive that we do every year to raise money for local food banks. It is one of those things that if you wait to the right amount of time into the winter, when Christmas is over, they're started running out of stuff. So we like to do it in February, so it kind of restocks. And believe me, it restocks a lot.
Yeah.
The people who come to Dead of Winter are, I'd have to say, the most generous customers, guests that we have, because they bring tons, literally tons. We had 1 year, we had 2 tons of stuff.
They're way nicer than
donated.
We are.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
so,
that's
you know,
crazy.
We just throw the party. They're the ones who make it happen. But people bring canned goods, non-perishable items, paper towels, toilet paper, light bulbs, socks. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything that people can use. You know, it's been a tough couple of years for really everybody.
Right.
But for, you know, people on a lower, you know, income level, it's really been a tough couple of years. And there's no backup plans now. That's all over. And yet, we're still dealing with a pandemic.
Sure.
And there is no special unemployment. There's no special anything helping anybody out. There are not even child tax credits anymore. So you're really, you know, if you're in trouble, it's you go to your food bank, and we want to make sure they've got a plenty of stuff to get through the winter. Mm-hmm. So that we do that every year, and it's something we've been doing. We do it at the Mineral Springs. It's February the 12th. It starts at 10 a.m. That's when Cody and I will usually intro things, and then Cody and I usually kick things off with our live podcast. And we're doing it a little different this year. I'm not going to be reading stories. We're going to be it's going to be a little more interactive this year, because it will be our 100th episode of the podcast.
100 episodes.
So for those of you who may have heard our last episode, you know that, and we've been getting them, so thank you. But we've been asking people if you have questions or comments, mm-hmm. or anything that you want to hear on the podcast, send it to us. You can send it to Cody at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. You can send it to ghosts@AmericanHauntings.net, whatever. We've gotten them in both places. So send those in, and we will feature them on the show.
Yes.
And we are also working on a podcast listener of the year. It's not really a great award. You don't really get anything,
no.
But you will get a shout out on the show. So if you think maybe you are the podcast listener of the year, we want to hear from you too. So tell us why you are, and we're going to pick from those.
That's an award.
We're going to give someone an award.
I would not want to win.
No, me either. But you know, some people like this show. Unlike us, we hate it.
It's wild.
Some people like it.
I have been getting questions and things like that coming in. But also yesterday, I received my first roast of you from our friend Kaylin, which I will also...
I'm happy with that too.
Which I will also probably include in that live show. It's a pretty good one. I think you're going to like it.
I'm sure it is.
But yeah, podcast listener of the year, let us know what's going on.
Yeah, questions. Tell us why it's you.
Questions.
We'll feature you in the show.
Yes, questions for Dead a Winter, whatever you got, AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. I'm really excited. I love Dead a Winter because I make this joke all the time, but it's the one nice thing a year that I do to try to offset all the other stuff, but we always get so much stuff, and
I don't know.
One year, I want to do something crazy, like a helicopter and a pallet of toilet paper or something. Just do something fun. But
You can find the details. I should have said that. You can find the details at AmericanHauntings.net. Dead of Winter is on there. It's going to be as of Monday. Well, by the time you hear this, it'll be moved right up to the top of the page, so you can easily find it. And click on it. It'll give you information about what's going on, what's needed, et cetera, et cetera. So we've also got a lot of dinner events and river road tours coming up in the winter and spring. I'm just going to throw that in there, mm-hmm. Because people think there's nothing to do in the wintertime. We got all kinds of stuff to do.
Yeah.
Always. We've always got stuff coming up. So check that stuff out, too. That's at dinnerandspirits.com. And then, come see us.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we have some more positive listener reviews, even though we've been putting out new episodes. We have a new season. We're still getting nice reviews.
Oh, good.
Which is awesome. And that's the positive feedback that I need. This review is from RWREA22. There's no way I can. Okay. And it's just titled Love the Show. It says, I'm happy that the new season has started. I've missed my every other Tuesday lunch entertainment. As you say, American Hauntings is more than a podcast, and it's now coffee. I purchased the Mineral Springs Hotel Blend and Abe Lincoln Seance Blend. Both are excellent. Is that what I'm looking at right
here? Yeah, that's
here?
The coffee okay. Right over there. Yeah.
I have not tried it yet.
Oh, yeah. It is. Bad Dog Beanery, they will be at Dead of Winter. They all have a little coffee shop Dead of Winter, so you can try it then.
Mm-hmm.
But they will, they'll have coffee. They're going to be here with the setup. So you can try some of this stuff there from them. But they actually used to do the coffee for our store that we used to have, mm-hmm. Taylor Mercantile. In fact, it's still got the Taylor Mercantile logo on our bags.
Oh, nice.
So we kept it on there. But they used to do the coffee for us. And I'm not a big coffee drinker, but that's good coffee.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, it's really good. So
awesome. I'll have to try it out. Yeah. Whenever I had an office to go into when that was a thing. It was, startup hipsters, all that stuff. So we had a ton of different ways to make coffee and everything.
Sure.
And there was a coffee club, people were really into it.
Yeah.
And so I learned a lot about it. But my favorite trick, what I used to do, is I would just stop drinking coffee for 2 weeks and then hit it really hard on a Monday and just be fucked up
all day.
I loved it. Flying high. And then you let your tolerance go down again and then hit it again. And But if you when you start depending on it every morning,
sure, I can see that.
But if it's really, really good, I'm excited. Okay, I'm going to try it out.
All right.
Are you ready to dive in?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
This episode. Okay.
There's a lot to take in.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about witches and the colonists and generally lay the groundwork here.
For our next several episodes.
For the next several episodes.
Yeah.
I have a lot of questions.
Okay.
can you explain to me kind of, you talk about this in the episode, and maybe it's because I haven't heard it, I've just read it, but can you talk to me about the difference between magic and like foreign religions and those sorts of things? Like, so there are people that would like practice some things, but then also then go to church. Like,
well, you're talking about folk magic.
Yes,
which magic is the majority of what, you know, was going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The witchcraft that they carried over from, or the idea of the witchcraft they carried over from Europe, was always about, you know, worshiping Satan, mm-hmm, and always doing, you know, evil things, because that's what they knew from Europe.
Yeah.
Where the real witch trials were. You know, we talk about in our next episode, you know, we're going to talk about Salem. And we, in this episode, we talk quite a bit about witch trials, accused of witchcraft and things like that. But what we find in America was that most of the time that was based on, well, it was based on like bad neighbors.
Yeah.
You know, and if you had a problem with someone, you could accuse them of being a witch, and they're screwed,
right?
Because the religious authorities at the time, who were also mostly, at least in New England, were also the government,
mm-hmm,
who ran everything. They truly believed in witchcraft, because in Europe, the witchcraft trials, and I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people,
yeah,
were tortured and killed for being witches. It was a mania. It was a frenzy. Nothing. We never saw anything like that here. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, there were a lot of people who were persecuted and tortured. And for the most part, what you would find, it would be old people or unusual people, or, you know, somebody, a couple of the people I talk about in this episode were just assholes.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, they were just assholes.
Yeah.
And people didn't like them, so you accuse them of being a witch. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean they were even doing anything.
Doesn't mean you should be put to death.
It was easy for the Puritans to point to the people who were, and when I say folk magic, by that I mean a lot of, yes, there were often spells and charms involved, but that's the icing on the cake.
Mm-hmm.
The real, most of what was going on was herbal healing, herbs, you know, things that were outside what they considered to be medicine,
sure,
which, you know, medicine was not really much of anything. But when you're using plants and herbs and roots and powders, and you are doing things for people, I mean, folk magic, a lot of it was a sympathetic magic thing. And I got to take this one piece at a time. It can be very confusing. But let's start with the healing thing. With a lot of these people, especially these women, were outside the norm, because they were doing things that women weren't supposed to be doing, for starters.
Reading.
Reading, yes, things like that.
Being literate.
So, you know, when people were getting sick, you know, they would have a powder or a root that might help, you know, mm-hmm, cures a headache or something. Nobody else had anything like that. There was no medicine to speak of,
sure,
at the time. Or, you know, they were midwives, or they were, you know, bandaging people up and realizing that if you didn't keep it clean and if you didn't keep some kind of salve on, and it was going to get infected. They didn't understand germs or things like that, but they knew,
yeah,
enough of this. So there was a lot of that going on, and that bothered the Puritans, because as far as they were concerned, if you were sick, then you aren't praying hard enough.
Right,
that's essentially
right,
what it boiled down to. There was also a lot of charms and spells and things that kind of went with the roots and the powders. Because if you are, let's say that you're taking some kind of powder to cure your, let's say you've been throwing up for a week, and you need something that's going to help you with your nausea, and there's a plant that does that, they give it to you, but it's going to really make you feel better about it. And it's probably going to work better if you believe it.
Yeah, of course.
And if you've got a spell that you can say along with it, that's even better, because in your head, I'm not going to debate the reality of magic. I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying, though, is that with sympathetic magic, you believe in it. As long as you believe in it, mm-hmm. it's gonna work better.
Sure.
I mean, it's just, it's the power of positive thinking. And whatever you want to say, it's been around forever.
Positive thinking,
you know, it's
yeah.
been around forever. So these were the kinds of things that people were doing. And so when you could go to church, you could be a good church goer, but you know, if you had a toothache, you know, the lady down the road that mixes up charms and herbs and roots, you're going to go see her because she's going to have something that's going to cure your headache.
Right.
And if that means you've got to say a little spell to go along with it, well, then that's the way it goes.
Give me that Novocaine.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but the Puritans, that did not fly with them. And so that's why in New England, they had such a hatred for, and I know I'm jumping way ahead.
No, yeah,
but
it's fine.
That's why they had such a hatred for folk magic, mm-hmm. is because to them it was the work of the devil.
Right.
Or it was the work of the Native Americans or the work of the Africans that were
people
brought
different
in as slaves.
Than us.
Anybody who was different than they were.
Yeah.
They were white, they were plain, they were strict, they were religious, and it was their way or the highway. And that's why, you know, as we find later in this episode, that, you know, the New England area saw the majority of the witch trials mm-hmm. and the majority of the accusations, because I was just about to say even strict religious people, especially strict religious people, found that there were ways to screw over other people yeah. because they wanted their land or they wanted their property or they just wanted them out of their business or wanted to take over their business. A good way to do that is to accuse someone of being a witch.
Mm-hmm.
And you were probably, there's a good chance you could lose everything,
right.
And including your life,
yeah.
if it really went far enough.
That's so crazy, strict religious people not understanding and believing in science. It's
I know,
weird,
isn't it crazy?
It's yeah. a weird thing.
No, it's crazy.
So that all is very interesting, and something I was thinking about when I was going over these episodes and everything, I was thinking about if you believe in God and creation and he put these everything, the world together and all this stuff, it's like, why wouldn't you think, okay, maybe he put this plant here that can help us
yeah.
compared to somebody who's yeah. screaming at the sky?
Are you trying to get me to get people mad at me again?
No, but just that screams.
But are you trying to? Because you know what I could say to this, right?
No.
Okay.
Yes, you do.
Going to say it.
Okay, well,
I'm not going to get us in
more. But it
trouble.
Just seems like that seems more witchcraft and scary to me.
It's I know,
just,
right?
Getting on your knees and yelling up into space and yeah. hoping something happens.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's the irony. But, okay, a couple other things I wanted to ask about. Witch trials took time to happen because accusers needed to build a case over time, you said, which I didn't know that.
Right.
I
that's
thought
not
it was
an
just like,
that's not an immediate thing. You can accuse someone of being a witch, and then they would be taken before, you know, a tribunal or a group of ministers or whatever, and they would kind of run the first check on
like
it.
Like a grand jury sort
yeah,
of thing?
Kind of.
Like
yeah, it is kind of like that. Okay. And then if you were found that you were probably, or there's a good possibility you were a witch, then you would be bound over for trial.
Uh-huh.
But they would bring people in and would question them and bring in witnesses to tell questions about how they were, you know, their cow died or their chickens died.
She turned
or
me into
she,
a newt.
Oh, some of this stuff's crazy. I mean, this is, I mean, I did talk quite a bit about some of this stuff about chickens dying and people claiming that they're being ridden by witches and
yeah.
that they witness, you know, they witness them meeting out in the woods, you know, for a Sabbath with the devil and, you know, like the
yeah.
end of the witch,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
that kind of stuff. But, you know,
I did like that part.
Yeah, it's you know, or you know, or they would take the they love urine in these stories.
Yeah,
yeah, there's a lot of urine,
I have questions
a lot of urine going
that.
On, and or the one I like is let's throw them in the pond, and if they sink, oops, they must have been innocent. If they don't sink, then oh, they must be a witch. So let's hang them. So
I mean,
talk about lose.
I don't, you know, fucking get it.
Yeah, but I mean, but these were things that were done.
This is
and
so,
so and,
then,
and they
stupid.
Would check. They would strip these. Now, see, when we talk about the witch trials in Europe, and they were very graphically. I mean, you've got like monks and priests who are stripping women down and sticking hot pokers in their vaginas.
Yeah.
And I mean, just insane, really insane stuff. I mean, it's bad enough that in a lot of these, they were stripping these women down looking for a mark, a witch's mark on their body.
Right.
Which if you found one, and it could be anything, it could be a pimple, it could be a mole, it could be anything. And that they saw that as evidence that you have
so
a familiar or an imp that you are feeding
yeah.
with this nipple, which is not a nipple, but they say that it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's, and you could be, that's evidence that you are a witch.
Dumbest fucking.
I know it's insane, but it served a lot of purposes.
Well, sure.
To a lot of people. And it's also was all just insanity, mm-hmm. religious insanity. It's the best example of a mania that we saw in that early part of the country. But believe me, there have been plenty of others over the years. I mean, there are huge.
Name 10.
Yeah, well, that's easy. I got an entire book of it.
I'm sure.
I've got a whole book of religious mania that I wrote. But there's been a lot of it, but this is really the first. I mean, mm-hmm. this is the first time that we saw people just losing their minds over, you want to say it's over religion, but I'm not sure that covers all of it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an insanity and there's a mental illness, a hysteria involved in this that just goes beyond just religious mania, I think.
People who wanted to inflict pain on others,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, I'm sure
power trips.
Power trips, yeah, definitely. You know, because that's what, I mean, really, being the Puritans, that's what it was about. I mean, they left England because they didn't feel the Church of England was pure enough for them, because they could do it better.
Right.
And as I always like to say, they left England because they were persecuted so they could come to America and persecute people here.
Yes.
You know, so I don't think that's all that uncommon, but you really get it with them.
Okay, my last question before we start having a more organized, I guess, conversation about this, but why is it that, I guess, especially portrayed in movies, television shows, things like that. Why is it that we see witches burned when a lot of times they were
in England? Hanged? In England, there were quite a few of them who were burned. That was much more common there.
Okay.
I mean, and it didn't happen all the time, but it looks better in a movie.
That's fair.
I think that's a big part of it. But there were a lot of witches burned in England and Spain and Europe. But in this country, I think it's pretty rare. Somewhere I've got a breakdown of the numbers. I don't have it in this.
You got stats?
I do. I think it's in my
got a spreadsheet.
Devil and All His Works book. I think I've got the breakdown in there. But mostly in this country, they were hanged. And we'll talk more about a couple of things in the next episode. But normally hanging was how witches were executed, at least in this country.
You know, firewood's not plentiful. I understand.
Yeah, I suppose.
So if you have to pick. You get either hanged, burned, or crushed with rocks. Which one are you picking? Which way are you going out?
Well, I wouldn't go with burned, so I guess I'd go with hanged.
I think I'd go with hanged, too. Maybe hope my neck
maybe
breaks.
Maybe it'd be quick, you know, if it's a short. I mean, but I don't get the impression these weren't like, you know, we say the gallows, but we really just mean a tree.
Right.
So I don't know that. I don't think the scientific methods came in for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think at this point they were probably, you know, building a gallows where you had a certain amount of drop.
Just three guys pulling you.
Snap. Yeah, I think you just strangled, which I guess would be better than being burned, I suppose.
I don't know. If you've ever been hung or burned, you know, tweet at us. Let us know.
Let us know how that went.
Records are scarce from early settlers, like you talked about. What we know come from stories, letters, diaries, things that kind of survive from people coming over on boats. You already talked about them trying to escape the devil, only to find him waiting in the woods, forests, the fields of America. Witches were plentiful in America. They were found among settlers, but the real terror was about black magic being practiced by the Native Americans who didn't even know who the devil was.
Right. That was the writing that they were getting travel stories. See, travel books, we will later in the season, we'll get into a story where a travel guide got some people into a lot of trouble.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But, you know, travel writings were usually written by sometimes people who didn't even go there. But sometimes they would be written by people who did make a trip there and were scared by Indians. So went back and wrote about how, you know, terrifying and horrible they were.
Okay.
So hence you end up with them being, you know, black magic, minions of the devil, and I mean, which would mean nothing to the Native Americans.
Sure. So they just look at you with a confused face, like what?
Exactly.
And also, you already plugged it, but I did put a note in here to talk about your book, "The Devil and All His Works." I think that's my favorite book I've read of yours. Yeah, it's awesome.
A little more serious than a lot of my books.
It is,
but not very conversational.
Usually, you're very jokey, multiple people my friends that are a little bit more religious have like seen that book either on my shelf or like on my Instagram. And they're like, hold on, dude. And I'm like, you got to learn these things. Like if you read this, you might figure out why you are afraid of this book.
Well, what's interesting about that book is what I always say is that I wrote that book really just to prove that we are the devil.
Sure. Okay.
That it's not a separate entity, that we did all these things.
I think the devil's just like Santa Claus. Used to keep children, like make children behave. And we are children. okay. This section is just titled, I'll See You in Court. So a lot of these stories pretty much just came from people just wanting to sue other people. Uh-huh. Like you said, just kind of like, you piss me off.
Absolutely.
So we
say that you're a witch. You know, my cow quit giving milk. You know, my kids got sick. You looked at them funny.
Right.
You waved a finger in my direction and put a curse on my family. Seriously, these are the kinds of things people would take to court.
That's so crazy.
So you wonder, you know, we laugh about, you know, our court system getting clogged up with silly things like people spilling their coffee on them from
especially
McDonald's.
In Madison County.
And but imagine this stuff being brought into court. Now,
right.
You know, and it was. And these were actual courts.
Serious allegations.
There wasn't like a special witch court down the street where people went for frivolous things that were ridiculous. These were the trials. This is what was going on.
Right.
You know, what do we got on the docket today? Well, we've got two murders. We got three robberies. And some guy says his neighbor's a witch. Okay, bring them in. I mean, it was taken seriously.
There's got to be somebody is in that room just rolling their eyes until they pass
out. I don't think
out.
So. At the time.
You did
there
eventually
are a
talk
few
about
people,
one guy who
there
was
are,
like
well, that
fed
guy,
up.
But there are a few people who just were like, oh, come on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and wouldn't let it, and just would go, this is ridiculous. But there were enough people who took it seriously that it really, you know, it became a part of our history for almost a century.
I mean,
you know, a good 75 years of witch trials in this country. That's how fucked up this country is.
And I can see like,
Well,
as much as like, I would want to call that shit out. Like if it's either prove my point or get killed, I'd
right.
be like, I'd
that's,
shut the
that's
fuck
the
up.
Thing. People didn't. People
I would shut up.
How do you think some of these things happen?
Yeah.
When, you know, they'd have a run and, you know, hang a dozen people. People were afraid to speak up.
I don't want
to
be the
next
one. Because
you'll be next.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, wait on our next episode.
Girls are the worst. Anyway, we'll get to that. we already talked about the trial by ducking. Is this where that Monty Python skit came from?
All those Monty Python skits come from
there. Yes. Yeah. Oh, holy grail.
And I always like to say, somebody else said, well, I didn't expect that. And I said, well, that's because no one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
I say
that all the time.
You do always say that. Well, so I do have a question. I don't know if you know this as far as timelines go, but like, how long are we talking from like trial, conviction, execution? Like, how long is that stuff?
You know, I think that can vary. I know that in some cases where they would bring people in for, you know, the examination and decide, they could sit in jail. They could sit in jail for a week. They could sit in jail for a month. A lot of times, you know, when we say trials, we're often not talking about an official trial. We're talking about the examinations.
Okay.
And then when they bring in a court of magistrates for an actual trial, that's a little more formal. And you can't hang anybody without putting them on trial. So you can't just do it off an examination. So they're going to have to sit until... You know, because there wasn't always a judge in town. You would just have like this, a magistrate or a guy who was kind of like a step up from a justice of the peace kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, oh, okay, well, we've got enough evidence here that this person's a witch. So when we put them on trial, and then you have to wait for judges to be there and set up a panel, then they come, then they have a trial. And then at that point, you're guilty or not guilty. And that's when you'll be hung. And most of the time you were guilty.
Right.
When you're, most of the time, if you're accused of a witch, not every time, because we talked about some people who did go free, but most of the time, if they found enough evidence that you were a witch, you're screwed. So yeah, well,
you did mention like sometimes it would just be like a public apology or a fine, yes, but then yeah. other people were killed.
Well, yeah. Because the people with the public apology or the fine usually would be able to get away with that just from the hearing and would be given some kind of thing they had to do. But I think that before they could execute anybody, you had to go on trial.
Gotcha.
So
she's like, okay, yep, you got me.
Yeah, I'm a witch.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You did talk about a couple of what I've called hardcore witches. John Godfrey. Unusual because he's a man.
Right.
Starts, like you said, probably one of the assholes you were kind of talking about.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, for sure.
Stood in court 5 times over 30 years accused of witchcraft. Just a guy that likes to push his luck, I guess.
Yeah, well, and it was kind of a case of where he wasn't just accused of being a witch. He was like, you know, he sued all kinds of people, and then they would sue him. Then he ended up being, you know, he was accused of being theft, arson, perjury, all kinds of stuff. So he was back and forth in and out of court. Usually he was suing someone else. So, I mean, this was a perfect kind of guy and a jerk that, I mean, not only was he a jerk, but I mean, there's nothing about him that says, oh, he must be a witch. Mm-hmm. He's practicing black magic. No, he was just a pain in everyone's ass. Right. So that's what you do. You accuse him of being a witch because you figure if I can't get him for physical assault or arson, then I'm going to get him for being a witch because let's be honest, the evidence you need to put somebody away as a witch, really not that strong.
Yeah, that's pretty clever, so, I guess. Yeah. I'm so tired of this
is
guy.
A good way to get rid of him.
So. Oh, and then you're talking about Rebecca Greensmith. She and her husband are both executed. It says that she described all sorts of familiarity with the devil, yeah, including carnal knowledge of her body. Does that mean she fucked the devil?
According to her, that was her story.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that was her story. So, and there was the one I kind of commented on and made kind of a remark about somebody who witnessed a bunch of witches out in a pasture, obviously having described as having an orgy.
Mm-hmm.
I did make a little comment on that because I thought it was an interesting description. That's what she claimed, and that was something that would a lot of people, and again, that's one of those things that you used to hear a lot more in like the witch trials from Europe. Mm-hmm. You'd hear about people having sex with the devil, and there were all kinds of descriptions of what his penis looked like and all kinds of stuff. And it's some interesting stuff.
Is it like a snake with a pitchfork?
Yeah, no, but it's just like, where do people come up with this stuff? You know, and I understand why they did it. I mean, and like some of these people you talk about, you know, that like Rebecca Greensmith, why is she confessing?
Yeah.
You know, I always find that to be a good question. Why in the world do these people confess? Now, sometimes I think it's to stop them from being tortured.
Sure.
Or in some cases, if you confess, there's a chance that you can be, you know, absolved and free. But if you claim that you're innocent, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Because they are going, if they think you're a witch and you say you're innocent, they're going to hang you for sure.
It's all the evidence you need.
You know, so it's kind of like the being tossed in the pond, you know. It's a lose-lose, no matter how you look at it. But yeah, I've never understood sometimes why they confess.
Dude, if you put me in an interrogation room and you make it 59 degrees, I'll tell you whatever you want to hear in 45 minutes. I will tell you absolutely anything. So I can understand a little bit with that. Oh, God, that's terrible. It's Salem's around the corner, man. I mean, we've really laid the groundwork here for
2 weeks. In 2 weeks, we'll be back with our Salem episode, which I think takes all of the stuff from this episode and moves it into one story where you hear all of this stuff, but all at once. And then you put it on steroids because nothing we've talked about today will even compare to what happened in Salem.
It's like the practical application of it. And it's Salem witch trials. Not sexy, just frustrating as hell.
Yeah, they're insane. really it's insane.
So ridiculous. So I don't know. I'm going to try that next time somebody pisses me off, start flailing and screaming and just
accuse them of being a witch.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we have some new Patreon supporters, subscribers, and I just want to say thank you very much for supporting the show, Terry. And I also received a message on Instagram from one of our listeners, Jordan, whom I talked to randomly. She said, I was at Barnes & Noble because dopamine, and the guy checking me out was making small talk about the books I was buying. He told me he just started reading a book about axe murders, so obviously I was like, dude, you need to listen to this podcast. And the girl at the next register was like, yes, probably more exciting for me than you, but I've never run into anyone who already knows about American Honks podcast. Anyway, it made my day. Happy Friday. Which is awesome.
Cool.
People know That's who nice. We are. They know who we are and didn't hate us.
So, well, yeah, that's a plus right there.
That's the plus.
Yeah, that's the plus.
And I should have said this earlier. It's now time for our Ghostwriter segment. If you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre or a question in general for Dead of Winter, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. This email comes to us from Hillary, and the subject is Podcast Rex. It says, hi, Troy and Cody, mostly Cody because I get the vibe he's predominantly in charge of answering these. I've been a longtime fan of Troy's and somehow only discovered the podcast a few months ago. I've been listening nonstop ever since. It's fantastic. You both do a terrific job. I'm officially caught up and feeling that slight letdown of not having a new episode to listen to right away. So I was wondering, I'm a big fan of Western Europe hauntings and ghost stories, namely the UK, Ireland, France. I'm wondering if either of you know of a good podcast that covers similar content to yours, but based in Europe. Thanks again for all you do and keep it up. Do you know any podcasts?
I listen to a podcast called Uncanny.
Okay.
Actually, I will give you two recs by the same guy. Danny Robbins does a podcast called Uncanny, but he also did one called the Battersea Poltergeist. And both of them are based in Britain. The Uncanny has other stories around Europe. That's really the only European ones I listen to, but I would recommend them both. Mm-hmm. The Battersea Poltergeist is just phenomenal. And Uncanny has only had one UFO episode, which I did not listen to, but I listened to all the others.
I thought you were kind of getting into some of the UFO.
No, I don't really.
I thought you told UFOs. Me some of that shit started to be interesting to you. No, didn't not we really. Have that conversation?
No, it wasn't me. It was someone else. You dreamed it.
Dude,
it wasn't me.
Totally you.
But I do recommend Uncanny. It is a good web. It is a good show. I like that one. That's really the only. I don't listen to a lot of paranormal podcasts.
I don't
they
really
just don't
either.
Really.
I'm just tired.
There are a few. I mean, I mostly listen to horror movie podcasts and true crime podcasts, mm-hmm. and then I got a couple that are just kind of a daily thing that are I just enjoy. But
your daily affirmation podcast.
I listen to the Steve Dahl podcast, the guy out of Chicago, so which I've been listening to since like 1982, so when he was on the radio. But I don't listen to a lot of paranormal podcasts, but I do listen to those. Mm-hmm. Those are both really good, and every once in a while, one will pop up that I do listen to.
Yeah.
So it just varies. It really does.
I would also recommend there's a podcast called Unexplained with Richard McClain Smith. To be honest, I haven't listened to it in a couple seasons, but I saw he just published a new episode not too long ago, and it's just a scripted monologue, but he definitely is, I think he's from the UK.
Astonishing Legends.
Astonishing Legends,
but that's not...
It's not exclusively...
That's not Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not really Europe or England, and it's not exclusively paranormal,
but yeah,
I do like those
They'll
guys.
Talk about a lot of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
If you're into more horror comedy stuff, last podcast on the left has covered some UK stuff, I think that's probably it. I don't know if any of our listeners have any recommendations.
Yeah, send them in and we'll pass them on.
Yeah, so send them on. I have her email address, so I can hit you up. So thank you, Hillary. That's all I got, man.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess really I just want to say thanks for listening. And thanks for continuing to share the podcast with your friends. Thanks for continuing to give us reviews, even the bad ones, because we're going to use them all at Dead of Winter.
Oh boy,
so mean tweets.
Mean tweets.
So anyway, thanks for the reviews and things. Review us on iTunes, even if you don't listen to us on iTunes. just because it does help us a lot that way. And that's the only place that we can really find the reviews.
Right.
They're easier to find there. So, but I do want to mention, Cody mentioned Patreon real quickly. Check us out on Patreon. It's at patreon.com, American Hauntings. We just sent out a bunch of new packets to everybody who'd signed up back in December. So everybody's got a bunch of new stuff in the mail. We do special things. There are different levels of the podcast that you can get involved with. We really appreciate the support. As Cody can tell you, well, anybody can tell you if you go back and listen to our early episodes and then listen to these, that
shit got rough.
The reason why is because we actually have stuff that works now rather than how we used to do it. So that's always been a plus. Don't forget one other thing. Use the podcast discount code.
Oh, yeah.
Guys, I always want to stress that. And people are finally starting to remember again that
if you go
to AmericanHauntings.net and you want to buy books, all you got to do is put in the word podcast and it'll give you 10% off automatically. So, and there's bigger discounts you can get through Patreon. So,
that's true.
But anyway, that's it for me. So thank you guys for tuning in for another season. And we hope you're liking this new season.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not, you cannot blame Cody. This was completely my idea.
I sprung it on him.
And so if you're not liking the way this is going, hang in there for one thing, because this season is going to go in a lot of different directions, but hopefully you're enjoying it. And if you are or aren't, let us know. I'm not going to change.
Yeah, if you don't like it,
for the whole
we
year.
Don't care.
I guess I'm going to have to say you're don't listen, but you know, still we'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah.
Well, within reason. So.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, that's it for me.
I don't want to make this too peppy and piss Troy off against this episode of the American Hauntings podcast.
It's only the title.
It was written by Troy Taylor and
that's
it's produced
all.
And edited by me.
I was just complaining. Okay.
Cody Beck.
Sorry.
Music for this season is performed by Troy's good friend that I don't think exists, Packy Lundholm.
Well, you know, this is not me playing the music.
That's
you know, this is not true.
I've never seen you play the guitar.
Exactly.
I've never seen you not play the guitar.
So
you can check out Packy and find out about his music and upcoming shows on Twitter, Instagram, Bandcamp, SoundCloud, and Facebook. And
in our show notes.
Yes. Yeah. And you can find us on most of those places too. Plus, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcast. You can find the website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com.
Have you been keeping that up?
What?
The podcast website.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just asking. Well, yeah. There for a while, people bitching.
Sometimes
people always bitching.
I forget. So. Sometimes I forget. Yeah, but
see,
no. But
for with good reason then, apparently.
Yeah,
so,
well,
all right.
Well, see, you know, okay, here's the thing. Somebody went into the AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com/episodes, and the latest episode wasn't there because it was on the front page of the website. And they were like, where is it? And I was like, I didn't put it there yet because it was enough that
wow,
I could do to get up
new.
At 6 a.m.
Come on,
man, and get it there.
The easy part.
But,
so.
But no.
All right, sorry.
I've definitely fucked that up before. But yeah, check out AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com for more info about the show, notes, photos, links, all that fun stuff. Thanks for listening. We couldn't, and we wouldn't.
Definitely wouldn't.
We would not do it without you. So until next time, goodbye. So long.
See you later. Excellent. Awesome.
So that was a different kind of episode, I think. But
yeah.
I think it's good.